Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
You're listening to New Books in Geography, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm your host for today, Stentor Danielson, from the Department of Geography, Geology, and the Environment at Slippery Rock University. Today, I'll be talking to Bjorn Sletto and Joe Bryan, editors of Radical Cartographies, Participatory Mapmaking from Latin America, published in 2020 by University of Texas Press. Dr. Sletto and Bryan, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Thank you.
So to start off, why don't you each tell our listeners a bit about your background and how you came to work on this book?
Do you want me to start, Stentor?
Yeah, go ahead.
So yes, thank you again, Stentor, for inviting us to this, to the podcast. I am originally from Norway. I've been in the United States for a few years now. I have a PhD in community and regional planning from Cornell University, and I teach here at the University of Texas at Austin in the community and regional planning program. And my teaching involves student research and travel to Latin America, especially Dominican Republic, where I've been working on informality and community development by community organizations. And I used to spend a lot of time doing participatory mapping in Venezuela before, but more recently I've been focusing on urban issues.
Yeah, so this is Joe Bryan. I'm a professor at the University of Colorado Boulder in the geography department. And like Bjorn, I got my start with participatory mapping really as working with communities. In particular, I would say one place I sort of got started with this involves a case that's described as one of the chapters in the book involving Quechua people in lowland Ecuador. And we were there, we were trying to figure out how to document and sort of make visible the impacts of proposed oil development on Quechua communities in the lowlands. And mapping was one of the strategies that we sort of thought about using. At that time, mapping was very difficult and technically intensive. We had literally boxes of floppy disks with ARC info on it that we were supposed to try to learn how to use. And we didn't get very far. But we started making hand-drawn maps there, and that was an idea that really stuck with me. And then since then, I've gone on to work with indigenous communities really around the Americas on mapping issues, oftentimes producing maps in conjunction with land claims, as I did with my work in particular in Nicaragua on the Awatzingni case. I also spent some time as one of the co-directors of the Indigenous Communities Mapping Initiative that ran from 2000 to 2004, that supported four different Indigenous communities here in the United States that were working on developing their own mapping project. And I've kind of just kept at it since then. In the book, one of the chapters is by a collaborator of mine from Oaxaca, Mexico. And we first connected after a controversy surrounding indigenous maps happened there in 2007 to 2009, roughly, that I've written about in another book that I have and that is mentioned some in the book.
Okay. So I want to start by asking you about the title of the book, which is Radical Cartography. And you introduce this term as something that's different from, you know, establishment cartography, but also kind of goes beyond what we're usually thinking of when we use terms like participatory mapping or counter mapping. So could you tell us what exactly is radical cartography and what makes it radical?
Good question, Stenter. Thank you. I think just to answer that question, I think maybe stepping back just a little bit to, as Joe indicated too, I also got started with participatory mapping as sort of principally a process for what Nancy Peluso refers to as counter mapping. So in other words, producing maps that would be provide a counter narrative to existing state maps, right? So that was my work in Venezuela for about 10 years, working with a Pemón on the border with Brazil and with the Yucpa on the border with Colombia. And the sort of the tradition that I sort of came in from was a more of an empirical tradition where the purpose really was to provide information about land uses, about sacred sites, about locations of various land use activities in the space that was claimed for as territory by indigenous groups. And I think as I worked in this area, I came to appreciate more and more the multiple uses of maps and the multiple sort of engagements and dialogues that happen around the map production itself, right? So thinking more about the process itself and learning from my collaborators and friends and partners in these communities that map making was much more than just empirically tracing on the piece of paper or producing a GIS. It also involved storytelling and involved negotiations over sort of the direction of social change in communities, over relations of power in the community, the meanings of places and so forth. And that really sort of drew me to thinking about map making more broadly than simply a counter mapping in sort of empirical Cartesian terms. And I think we're using, to me, I guess, and Joe will have his own perspective, to me, we're struggling for a term to sort of refer to this broadening of the sort of social and political impacts of maps and the broadening of uses and the broadening of deployments of these technologies, and came to the term radical as a way of signifying this sort of broadening politics of map making.
Yeah, to pick up on what Bjorn has said, I think part of this radical politics is based on indigenous peoples and Black communities' actual experience of producing these maps. And I think that that's one of the things that really leads in all the chapters of the book, is that at this point, many communities, indigenous and Black communities in many parts of Latin America, have been involved in map making for 2 to 3 decades at this point. And they've compiled extensive experience with that process that is now starting to shape their own practices and approaches to map making. And to give you a sense of kind of what that means in really concrete terms, you know, for example, if you want to use a map to make a territory visible to a court, say, one of the first things that you need to do is to draw boundaries around it, to produce a bounded territory that can be recognized by a court and can be demarcated by such. Now, indigenous communities that I have worked in, oftentimes this is a pretty easy thing to start doing. Like, they know exactly where, they have a strong sense of where their territory is, the space that they've lived in, both historically and in the present. But how then to start to represent that with a set of lines drawn around it to make it look like a territory to outsiders is actually a little bit more complicated. And one of the things that really came to the fore in mapping projects that I've worked on is that people really became conscious of how mapping and the sort of claims process itself was actually setting the terms by which they were drawing their territory. For example, if you asked people in, say, a community where I've worked quite a bit in eastern Nicaragua, Awatsitngi, to draw a map of their territory, initially that map wouldn't have had boundaries on it the way that we think of boundaries, as these hard kind of lines that are show up as heavy dark lines on a map that also can be then demarcated and physically surveyed on the ground. It's not to say that they don't have boundaries, but to say that that understanding of boundaries is very different. And what you see then in the mapping process, when it's driven by claims, is a kind of a hardening of these boundaries, so that the terms of recognition are that, how do we make our territory visible to outsiders, to courts, to state governments? And that has powerful ramifications for communities themselves. And oftentimes, you get to the situation where the territory that's recognized is not something that is recognizable by the very people that it's meant to benefit. And so this has fed into new ways of how do we represent and how do we sort of show relationships to land, territorial rights, in ways that sort of break with the ways in which we would think about these in a very conventional manner from looking at maps or thinking with maps. And so the radical part of this really gets into some of the innovation and experimentation that communities have driven themselves to figure out how to sort of address these problems. And there's a number of chapters in the book that go extensively into this. For example, Pablo Mancias has a piece about mapping Walmapu, which is the Mapuche territory that covers a large chunk of the southern cone in what we would recognize as Argentina and Chile. And really their project is to sort of, how do you show that space as Mapuche people both see it and understand it, but also as they would want to live in it. Another example comes from the chapter by Melquiades or Quiado Cruz, talking about oral cartographies in Oaxaca. And he goes into a sort of elaborate detail about how people have their own stories about sort of how this landscape came to be that are oftentimes X'd out or crossed out of conventional maps that tend to oftentimes sort of reduce historical questions to sort of, are you traditional? Are you doing traditional land use? And that's sort of to the extent to which history is engaged with. So there's a lot of sort of experimentation and reading back into the maps that makes these sort of these maps radical in the broad sense.
Okay, so that actually nicely sets up another question that I had, because you're talking there about some of the ways that cartography can be used to make things more legible to outside people like the state and so forth, and kind of make a political argument for something like land rights or something like that. And that's a very common theme in a lot of these case studies that are included in the book. But then some of them, you also see mapping being used for the community's own kind of internal purposes. You know, that's not just a map to show outsiders to say, hey, look, this is what our territory is or whatever, but it's also something that is useful within the community that's making this map. So I was wondering if you could talk about some of the, you know, the how those two different purposes for maps kind of connect or are in tension in some of these cases.
Yes, Denter, thank you for that question. I to build on what Joe said, I think the way we use the term radical is sort of a little bit tongue-in-cheek too, in the sense that participatory mapping, the way it was done in the 80s and 90s perhaps, and often with external assistance and so forth from scholars, in fact wasn't necessarily radical. It was often, like Joe said, maps produced on the terms of the state and external entities in connection with conservation planning, perhaps, and territorial reorganization and so forth. So it wasn't radical in the sense that we used the term. It was more like Joe said, you had to work with the terms, the cartographic terms of the state, and delineate those sharp boundaries, for example. And I think what's important here for this in this book is that we are indeed focusing on the appropriation and sort of reimagination of mapping by communities themselves. And with, I think, and from my experience in Venezuela, it's very clear cognizance of the fact that the state is indeed requiring certain data in the form of a map. And yes, we will produce that. We will do that through this mapping process. But that is just a springboard for a much broader use on our own terms of map making, right? So in the case of Venezuela, for example, with the Pemón, where I worked for many years and where I lived for a while, is the map making was also seen as a way of engaging youth by elders. It was seen as a way of engaging youth in conversations, really critical thinking about what is the future hold, what is the future hold for the communities, and where are we going in terms of social change, and you know, our concerns about the loss of language and so on came out in these mapping workshops. So it just became a forum for critical dialogue, and it laid a foundation for planes de vida, like life plans, like basically indigenous planning processes. It laid a foundation for a historical project to document historical sites and genealogies. And in the case of the Yucba in Western Venezuela, it really became a space for dialogue about the rapid changes and reclamation of hacienda lands, and which involved a lot of changes within the communities, movement of people within the community. So I think that is very important in this regard. Reminds me of the case of Manaus. There was that Emmanuel de Almeida wrote about in the Bejia Flor Aldeia, and which is a case of an urban case, right? Which is very interesting. It was a dozen communities, a dozen indigenous groups moving into Manaus and settling in the same area, and the map making really became a space for dialogue among the groups to forge an understanding of a sort of collective claim and a collective sense of urban indigeneity while still maintaining more traditional ties to their communities. So I think that's where we're getting at the radical from. That is, in fact, it is a change, it's an appropriation, it's a reimagination and new ways of using cartography much more broadly than the sort of territorial demarcation of the past.
I would add to Bjorn's sentiment there, in the sense that one of the questions that communities grapple with when they start mapping and when they start really a land claim process as well is what is this thing called land, or what is the territory? And it's seems like it should have a self-evident answer, but it's actually a lot harder to get at than you might think. And it sort of becomes a material problem or a concrete problem when you do things like, okay, how are we going to draw lines or boundaries around something that hasn't been mapped before or hasn't had those boundaries in the past? But Bjorn also mentions an important point too, in that you know, many indigenous and Black communities are communities that are in motion, or they're moving, and their territories kind of stretch and contract with those motions. Sometimes those motions are driven by dispossession. So when you have like a massive open pit mine, for example, that pushes a community in new ways. But and other times they're driven by other processes like migration. So for example, the chapter that by Melquiades Cruz in the book talks about a part of Oaxaca that is where many, many people have experience either themselves migrating to work in other parts of Mexico or in the United States, or have friends and family that have done that route. And as we sort of, in working with Cruz on some other projects, we've sort of dug into this idea of what is territory and this big question about like, well, how do migrants reshape the territory, or how do they shape this in new sort of shape spatial understandings of the community, as such, has been a real sort of pressing question that we've tried to like get at. And at the same time, communities are generating their own sort of questions as well. For example, again, in Oaxaca, the community that Cruz writes about and many others like it have community run radio stations. Some of them now have community run cell phone networks and internet access. And initially, these systems were built kind of by effectively hacking into kind of airspace. The initial response from the Mexican government was oftentimes to criminalize these activities, although they've now changed their tune dramatically and have adopted a stance more of regulating or licensing community-run media. But along the way, communities developed a really strong sense of the fact that airspace, that space that looks like it should be nothing, right? The electromagnetic spectrum is part of the territory in the sense that it's a medium, it's a that facilitates communication and connectivity. So it was a way of kind of seeing how territories can be formed in other ways that are not really easy to map, but start to get at the sense of territory as being much more expansive than just land or just resources, per se. And it's not to say that land and resources are unimportant. They're absolutely critically important, but it's to sort of develop a more multidimensional understanding of territory, which is often precisely what goes missing from maps.
And if I can add to that, good observation. Often in the work that I've done, I've faced situations with internal debates and maybe even conflict regarding land uses, and that are often a result of pressures from the state and from investors and from mining interests and so forth. And the mapping process then has become, instead of a process to follow state sort of imperatives in defining boundaries, has become a space for dialogue and negotiation in some case, and between groups. And I remember from working in Venezuela, the one of the things I would always say is that we don't have boundaries, like Joe is referring to. Our boundaries are much more nuanced and permeable and shifting. But for the purposes of this work, we are going to delineate boundaries, but we are not going to be delineating boundaries within these areas, even though there are, in fact, understandings and usufructs and traditions in how land is subdivided and used by different groups at different times. So I think one of the things that I wanted to get across in the book is this the politics and the great really awareness of the potentials of map making that goes beyond the let's make a map because the state requires it for our territorial claim. That is this piece, a part of it now. So and I think this was interesting too, returning to this point of flows and travel and shifting and changes, like, which is such an important theme in this regard. I'm reminded of David Pereira's chapter on the Quilombola land rights claims in Alcantara in Maranhão in Brazil. He was a PhD student here. We worked together for many years, and he was very cognizant, of course, of being a Quilombola intellectual, pursuing this struggle while living in the United States, while being separated from family. And during COVID and so forth, it was a very difficult time. And so we talk a lot about this flows of ideas and knowledges across boundaries. and the sort of what is that doing in terms of this attachments and understanding of territory, given all these movements. So I think the GAN returns to the point of the radical being in fact more going beyond the sort of required tracing of boundaries on the terms of the state.
Yeah, I think those themes all come across very well in the book.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
This episode is brought to you by Etsy. Looking to instantly upgrade your Mother's Day gift from typical to meaningful? Shop Etsy. Now until May 12th, get up to 30% off personalized jewelry, style, decor, and so many other items mom will love. And if you want her to know you put a ton of thought into her present, use Gift Mode. Gift Mode on Etsy takes the stress out of gifting so you can easily find well-crafted, original, and affordable pieces from small shops. Just tap or click Gift Mode on your Etsy app or Etsy.com. Then answer a few short questions about mom, and Gift Mode instantly gives you curated ideas based on hundreds of personas. Need something original and affordable for Mother's Day? Etsy has it. Shop until May 12th for up to 30% off gifts for mom. Terms apply.
So I now want to turn and ask a little more about, you know, how this book came together, because you've got 11 case study chapters written by different authors, and you've, you know, given shout outs to a few of them along the way so far. But I was wondering if you could talk about how you went about bringing this particular set of people together and, you know, turning their different perspectives into this book.
Do you want me to start, Joe, maybe? This is a very long story, Stenter, and it's really, I think, it's a fascinating story of co-production and learning across transdisciplinary production of a text. I guess one of the earlier starts probably was the conference that we put together, all of us, in 2011 at the Universidad de los Andes, thanks to Claudio Leal and colleagues in the Department of History, and with funding from the Rights and Resources Initiative and UT Austin, right? And that was a conference, I think, of about 50 participants who working with Rights and Resources, and Joe and myself, and Charles Hale, of course, who we have to mention as a really important co-editor and instigator of this project, who was the director of LILAS at the time, as well as Alfredo Wagner, who is a major figure in participatory and radical photographies in Brazil. We put together, I think, a fabulous group of people from about a dozen countries to speak on different aspects of participatory mapping, and including some short reflections in written form that were circulated during the conference. And I think that, to me, there was a very inspiring dialogue that I would say really brought home that the observations that I made from Venezuela were not limited to Venezuela. I could see that these very innovative and transformative uses and thinking about map making was happening, you know, throughout the region. And I would say to me, you know, that resulted in then an article that we produced that Joe and myself and others co-authored, where we sort of pulled out some major themes and really arriving at this understanding that maps are indeed being, map making is really indeed being transformed, like Joe said earlier, by the communities themselves. And then the question turns to the logistics, like how do we actually do this? How do we produce a volume that is indeed authored by people from across the region in working in very different circumstances in different languages? One of the ways that helped us a lot was a workshop that we put together here at UT Austin, where we brought in, I think that was in 2014, and we brought in, I think, 7 of the authors joined us here in Austin, along with Joe, and we started processing the chapters. I'd say some chapters already had a beginning. Others, we started with a conversation, and we also were able to use recordings from the Bogota conference and PowerPoint and so forth to start assembling an argument for each chapter. And then that process continued through my own dialogue with and meetings with the writers from Brazil and Skype calls and some personal visits. And I know Joe has his own story of working with Melquiades and Pablo in person. And then coming to this, to a place where we started editing these texts and returning them to the authors, and finally translation from Portuguese and Spanish into English. So it was a very interesting, involved process. I would have wished we'd had more chances for personal meetings, you know, but time and money and logistics makes it difficult. But I would say it was a really fascinating process of co-production of a text that crossed multiple boundaries, geographic and intellectual and personal and geographic boundaries, as well as epistemological boundaries. So I benefited a lot from it. I think I would say, at least speaking for myself, I benefited and learned a lot. I think others did too. And it's it really is a decolonial way, I think, of producing academic texts that I would love to continue pursuing in future work.
I think to add to Bjorn, I mean, Bjorn has given you some sense of this, and I can give you another gloss on it. But, you know, so much of what we know as people who are sometimes coded as mapping experts or experts in the field of indigenous mapping, that's all been built with working with communities. And sometimes it's places where we directly are involved in making maps, like Bjorn explained with the Pamon and Yucpa people in Venezuela in his case, or myself in Ahuastingni in Nicaragua, or in Oaxaca with Melquiades Cruz, or many of the other places that I've worked in over the course of my career. And I think one of the things that comes with that experience is a real profound debt of gratitude and recognition that the fact that many of our best colleagues are in communities. They're not in universities for all sorts of reasons. And that was then sort of paired with this awareness that there are very few opportunities for people to exchange ideas and experiences that sort of fall outside of the big kind of donor-driven conference, which could be, you know, it could be hosted by the UN, it could be hosted by a conservation organization, it could be hosted by an NGO. And not to say that those conferences are not useful and good, but as many of us who've participated in them know, that the really interesting stuff happens usually outside in the halls, where people are having informal conversations about what's really going on or what they're learning from mapping. And so that Bogota conference in 2010 really the idea was to center those conversations, to basically take the hallways and put them on center stage so that we can have this really sort of robust conversation about like, well, everybody's been doing this mapping stuff for a while. How's that process worked? What's it gotten you? Sort of what's a sort of critical take on it? And we left it open that in a way that really allowed for community-based researchers to sort of put forward their own ideas and expertise. And I think it was, you know, they've been involved in a few meetings like this. And one of the things that sort of ties them all together is just the overwhelming creativity that's associated with this. And not just creativity for sort of creativity's sake, but actually creative approaches to solving really tangible problems. Like an oil company is going to drill on our territory, and this is going to have huge effects for how we live here. How do we deal with that? How do we confront that threat? Or it could be mining, or it could be the expansion of a city. It can be so many of these different things. And so putting forward those experiences as actually the centerpiece of what we wanted to talk about was a really important part of kind of getting the idea of this book started. And then as Bjorn mentioned, you know, some of the authors in here have written and published more books and articles than I have as a professor. And some people, this was really their first time producing a text like this. And so a lot of the process then was, how do we kind of pool our experiences to sort of co-edit in a really meaningful way each other's works, and to produce a series of texts that we found would be useful both to scholars, more conventionally trained scholars like myself, who are working on these issues, as well as to help kind of share this information between communities. And that really is the sort of, I want to use a word in Spanish here, the nudo, the sort of knot that's at the center of this book that is tied together by everyone, kind of all the chapters, and sort of putting all their experiences on the table.
Yes, and if I to add to that, I think Joe alludes to the incredible creativity of the different mapping projects that were presented in Bogota, and the sort of the innovative solutions, the innovative ways of using cartographic tools to, for instance, like the case of the oil production and the contamination, like when De Pineda is writing about in Peru, for example, the uses of GPS and map making to provide real time documentation, for example. And I think I also would want to add that one of the things that I struggle with, or that I really tried to emphasize in this work, was that the book should be both about the experiential, have an experiential perspective, but also a theoretical edge. So what I found just incredibly powerful in my own work is in fact the theory making that happens through these projects that are coming out of these communities. And that is something that is often, well, for the most part, overlooked in the Western academia, you know. And I wanted to try to provide a balance between providing case material and examples of creative solution, but also reflections about the role of mapmaking for epistemologies, for preservation of history, for understandings of movements of people, and so forth. That's in fact emerging from these communities, and often sort of prompted or facilitated across the mapping table, as it were.
Just a footnote to Bjorn's comment, you know, a lot of the people, a lot of the contributors to this volume, they are all read everything they can get their hands on. And oftentimes that's stuff on the internet. But one of the things that is broken there is this idea that community knowledge, whether it's an indigenous community or a Black community, has to be authentic and only limited to what that community knows and where they sit. So, for example, in the chapter that I helped edit and translate by Melquiades Cruz, he at one point quotes Deleuze and Guattari, which is, for the academics out there, this is a notoriously difficult text to make any sense of. And yet, Cruz and many of his other colleagues in Oaxaca have read pieces and fragments of Deleuze and Guattari's work, and they have their own take on it. And they actually have found it really useful for thinking about some of the things that they want to describe in their own work, which was amazing because I had never really read Deleuze and Guattari prior to my conversations with Kiado Cruz from Oaxaca. And so that was kind of part of the conversation that was going on in here. And yet it's something that oftentimes reviewers of this book will kind of pick out, and they'll be like, why are they talking about Deleuze and Guattari in the middle of a chapter on indigenous knowledge? And miss the fact that like Western theory can be part of indigenous knowledge now. It's not like there's this sort of bifurcation or separation. And the same goes for Afro-descendant communities. I mean, they have a profound engagement with a lot of this stuff that's really coming to the fore, and that needs to be kind of part of the dialogue.
If I can add a footnote to Joe's, that was such a good, important point. I'm reminded of Davi Pereira and his colleagues who are in reading Black feminist thought emerging from the United States, and they're big fans of Bourdieu. And I think it's so important to, for us, it was very important to me to get across this, in fact, this agency of, in terms of developing theory in these communities. And that agency means drawing on thought from worldwide, drawing on worldwide inspiration. And I think that is something that is really important to get across to me, because it has been a tendency in the past to very much foreground the essentialized sense of authenticity in parts of these communities. And in fact, what I've seen in my own work and what's coming across in some of these conversations is the ways in which these communities and map makers are perfectly cognizant of that, are perfectly aware of that, and they will indeed use the narratives and use the symbology and iconography that might be associated with more sort of essentialist present representations, but knowing that they're doing that, and that I think is very important. And again, it goes back to the original questions about the radical being, we are in the position to in fact play this game, but on our own terms, that are using mapping technologies.
Okay, well, I think we've given our listeners a good sense of what's in store for them if they pick up this book. So to wrap up our interview, I'd like to ask you each what you're working on next.
Joe, do you want to go first?
Sure. I think that, part of what's come out of these projects, like what you see written about in the book, are these really fundamental questions about what are territories, how well can we use a map to represent that? Do we need to invent new forms of map making to go with that? And I have really developed a collaborative working relationship with Kiado Cruz in Oaxaca to kind of continue to push forward some of these ideas. And so we currently have a project going on community radio and community uses of media in Oaxaca that is taking us into a whole new sort of realm of digital and new media. And it's on the one hand, it might seem really esoteric. On the other hand, it kind of follows from these ideas of thinking about territory in more dimensions. But it's also brought us back around full scale to the fact that data mining is now a very widely used aspect of not just sort of surveillance and the things that we think about, but also development policy. And the real sort of global trend, and especially in countries like Mexico, is to use now data that's collected from community use of cell phones or radio or even community maps to drive and determine what the next development intervention should be. And this is a very sort of powerful way of doing things that's been, it's gotten a lot of attention and support from the World Bank, from the Mexican government, and it's sort of billed as being post-theoretical in the sense that the data is driving the interventions and not ideological or political concerns. And in fact, one of the things we're getting at with our project is that these things are profoundly, the data is profoundly political and needs to be thought about in these sort of new ways. So that's probably one of the biggest new projects that I have going right now. And again, is done in collaboration with Chiado Cruz, one of the authors of the chapters in this book, and then a group of collaborators in Oaxaca, Mexico.
And in my case, my work more recently has been very urban focused in the Dominican Republic, especially. And I think what I'm doing here is I'm picking up on the concepts of territory and how that is in fact is being used in productive ways by informal settlements and very marginalized communities in cities. And I was reminded of a conference that I was part of organizing in 2018 in the Dominican Republic, when one of the authors from Brazil, Emmanuel, was one of the speakers, and he talked about the territorial rights struggles in Brazil and the urbanization of indigenous communities in Manaus, and it struck such a chord among community members in the Dominican Republic in terms of struggles for rights to manage their own spaces. And this was taking place during a period of displacement caused by a massive stormwater project. And so I'm seeing these parallels with urban rights claims that I think are really important. And I think trying to draw those lessons into that space, I think is very important. I would say another great inspiration, I think, from this project has to do with co-production. And I'm embarking on the edited book project with colleagues in South Africa and Australia that will really look at learning as a way of bringing together both urban practice, planning practice, rights claims, and of course pedagogy. So I think one of the things that I'm drawing from this experience is an inspiration to really continue breaking down boundaries between activist, academic, community member, and so forth, and practitioner, and exploring and I'm trying to understand new ways in which these boundaries are troubled and broken down, and with a goal towards more liberalization, and I mean with towards democratization and rights for informal settlements.
Okay, well, that all sounds really exciting. So thank you both so much for coming on the show.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You just heard a conversation with Bjorn Sletto and Joe Bryan, editors of Radical Cartographies, Participatory Mapmaking from Latin America, published in 2020 by University of Texas Press.